This is the Freedom Fiends, broadcasting from Pod Bay 2A, a mile above sea level at Intergalactic Prairie Studios. We warm your locus coeruleus by rejuvenating your brain with radio waves to 165 degrees Fahrenheit. This keeps a sin flood of statism out of your brain. I am Mr. Michael Dean, the Iron Hamster. I am talking to Mr. Ben Stone, the Bad Quaker, also known as the Furry Possum, the Hairy Possum. What are you this week, sir? What's your radio wrestling name?
That'll work. Hairy Possum, Bearded Possum.
Hi, I'm Hairy Possum. How are you?
Well, Harry. Any of the above.
Well, Harry. All right, so we are doing part 10 today in our 36-part series, adopting and adapting the 12 steps, 12 traditions, and 12 concepts of world service of AA to our new 12-step fellowship,
Status Anonymous.
Yep. Yeah. We have to say it together. It brings the power of the voodoo up from the swamps. No, I'm kidding. It's not magic. It's not even science. It's just something that works. It's not the only way to leave the idea of loving this state and thinking you need emperors. But it is a good way, in the same way that the 12 steps of AA are not the only way to stop drinking and improve your life. But they are a time-tested, proven version that works. Simple way to do it. There seems to be a lot of need today for people to bash AA. It's the new hip thing, and I've actually seen a lot of Liberty people forwarding this article by this guy that this tyrant. No, he's not a tyrant. He's a psychiatrist. This article in Salon magazine, which is kind of funny when libertarians will like forward an article in Salon magazine, like, look, see, this must be true. AA doesn't work. And they like, they're ignoring the fact that the article that they're forwarding has ads on it of like Rachel Maddow's new, like 27 part series on why Hillary Clinton should be president. That's some selective filtering there, libertarians. 'Cause you know, you don't like Hillary. You think she's a liar, a socialist, and her feet stink. And she is. And they do. All right. So, we are doing step 10 of Status Anonymous, and Status Anonymous is something we came up with for dealing with the addiction to the state, dealing with the love of the state, the feeling that people cannot ethically organize themselves, which they can, that society needs rulers, that 51% can tyrannize 49%, and it's good, it's not. Yeah. That's statism. Statism is a disease, and we're dealing with that disease through examining it with the 12 steps of Statists Anonymous. So do you want to read the 10th step of Status Anonymous here, Ben?
Sure. We continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. I see this as kind of a self-defense element, a self-defense in the sense that, you know, if... Oftentimes with an alcoholic, they are their worst enemy. And you can try to blame it on the alcohol, you can blame it on other people, you can blame it on a lot of different things. But the reality is, for the alcoholic, they are oftentimes their worst enemy. And as you're going through these steps, and if you apply them to statism as we're doing, you can be your own worst enemy in a sense that you constantly are expecting the government to do stuff for you, or you're expecting the government to protect you and whatever. And really, self-defense, whether it's on a mental level or whether it's actual self-defense, like defending yourself walking down the street, is your responsibility first. It is your responsibility to defend yourself. It's not somebody else's responsibility to keep you safe. And if you're your own worst enemy, then you have to be honest with yourself and take those internal inventories and really have an honest look at yourself and find out why you are your worst enemy.
I have an example of how I was my worst enemy when I was drinking and doing drugs. I was in this band called Bomb that got signed to Warner Brothers, and that sounds like a cool deal, but actually, like, Warner Brothers didn't do very well by us and did put out one record and then dropped us and didn't support us at all. But it was, you know, that thing of kind of like, they they were signing a bunch of bands. This is before we got signed, like before Nirvana got big. Like we get like our, we were signed when they were signed. Our records came out around the same time, but there was kind of this push. It was actually, we and Nirvana probably got signed because Jane's Addiction was the weird band that came out and, made it when nobody thought they were commercial at all. So the labels were signing up all the good, weird bands and seeing what sticked, you know, without a lot of promotion, seeing what stuck to the wall. And they didn't push us very hard. But before that, this woman from Maverick Records, which was like Madonna's label, which and Interscope, I think they were connected. It was Interscope or I forget which one, but it was Interscope. They're both labels that like didn't just sign bands and see what would stick. They actually like signed bands and pushed them really hard. And she came to see us at Club Lingerie in Los Angeles. We were opening for Rage Against the Machine, who were unknown at the time. Also, they were trying to get signed too. And the lady came back, like, I didn't drink. I was a professional. I wouldn't drink during the show. Like, I would have one or two beers, but I would, as soon as the set was done, I would get slammed. I would slam like six or seven shots in a row. And I did that as soon as we were done. And the lady from Interscope Records came backstage and she, with my manager, and she said, I really like you guys. I think we can do business together. And in my mind, I was like Jim Morrison. I was like, well, what would Jim Morrison do? So I dropped my pants and exposed myself to her. And she said, well, forget it. I'm not going to deal with you guys. And I'm not going to make a big deal out of this. And then she looks down at me and says, not that I could. It was cold in the room. So, yeah, that was how I was my worst enemy. Like the label that would have made us stars, pushed us at least. So we had a chance, I blew it. Whereas, we ended up on the third or fourth choice, the safety college of Warner Brothers. And, you know, it's probably a blessing in disguise because if I had had the fame and money that I would have gotten probably from that deal, I probably would have ended up dead. You know, like the guy, the singer in what was the band? I really like them a lot. I'm drawing a blank right now. Alice in Chains.
Yeah.
Lane Staley. Yeah. You know, it's kind of funny. Like he died and Kurt Cobain died. And I kind of like, people used to tell me back then, I looked a lot like both of those people. Like my mother thought I looked like both those people. The guy in Alice in Chains, he was really tall though. Kurt Cobain wasn't that tall, but, the guy in Alice in Chains, Lane Staley died of drug use. And he was so messed up on drugs by the time he died. Like he was a millionaire, but he looked like he was a star living in a third world country with no food. I mean, he was 6'2" or 6'3". And when he died, he was 89 pounds. Can you picture how skinny that is? 6'2", 89 pounds. All right, man. So it's probably a blessing in disguise that even though I was being my own worst enemy may have worked to save my life. So, you know, when I got dropped from Warner Brothers and my band broke up and I was still my own worst enemy, but at least not to the point where I did go and get into recovery. I had to give up drugs. He was able to keep doing drugs. He had enough money to keep doing them until they killed him, put it that way. I had a financial incentive to stop because I was broke and I didn't want to be a thief. So, yeah, man. That's my little aside on being one's own worst enemy. And that's valuable to have stories like that. I don't do that to entertain. They are entertaining, but it's more so anybody listening who's done stupid things for drugs or alcohol or for the state or for, bad people or bad ideas, which is what we're about dealing with here with this 12-step fellowship, Status Anonymous, might recognize in themselves. Because the reason 12 steps work where like the recovery industrial complex won't sometimes, you know, because like the recovery industrial complex is like people with PhDs who've never had a problem with drugs or alcohol. And the people who have problems with drugs and alcohol can't relate with them. They're like, you're treating me like a chapter in a book somewhere, you know, whereas the alcoholic or addict who's in recovery can talk to the still suffering alcoholic or addict and say, I'm like you. Let me tell you this story. Does any of this ring true? Okay. Let me tell you how I did it. It's a peer to peer thing. And it's kind of weird to me that there's this thing in Liberty now of trying to bash 12-step fellowships because, you know, the basically the other alternative other than white knuckling it and quitting it on your own, which you kind of did, Ben, but you kind of had some spiritual component in there too. But the pretty much the things that are available to people to quit drugs or alcohol are 12-step fellowships or white knuckling it with maybe some spiritual stuff on the side like you did, or also, like, you know, the only other thing is the recovery industrial complex, which is paying a lot of money or having the state pay a lot of money or having your insurance pay a lot of money to go either inpatient or outpatient to a facility where, like, people with PhDs who don't understand what you're going through from a personal level are treating you like a chapter in a book. And the bizarre thing is to me that, like, libertarians like Tom Woods and people who back him on this, and I like Tom Woods otherwise, but he's been kind of bashing AA and you know, praising Harvard PhDs who are part of the recovery industrial complex. The thing is, here's the way to look at it, and this is entirely accurate. The recovery industrial complex is the central banking of recovery. AA, 12-step programs, NA, Status Anonymous are the Bitcoin of recovery. You know, it's anonymous. You don't have to be on any list anywhere. If you go to recovery industrial, if you go to, like, you know, any of those clinics that cost a lot of money or even the ones that don't, you're going to end up on a list as someone who's had a problem with drugs and alcohol. They're going to use that to round up your guns at some point. They're going to have, you know, have it on record that you had a problem with drugs. It's the central banking of recovery. So we like the 12-step way. And we're dealing with statism, Status Anonymous. And statism isn't just the belief that of someone saying that I need a leader. It's also them saying that we need a leader. You know, when you're a statist, you're not just saying you need to be led. You're saying that your neighbors need to be led too. And that's immoral. Right. Wouldn't you say, Ben?
Absolutely. You know, I think that's a really good comparison, comparing Bitcoin to AA, because, you know, with us on the road all the time, I forgot we have a cough dump now, but yeah, with us on the road all the time.
You have about 10 seconds before we go to break, too.
Yeah, I've really seen how convenient Bitcoin is compared to central banking.
Yeah.
We'll get back into that when we come back, though.
Yep. And if you were going to AA, you could go to an AA meeting in every town, too.
True, yeah.
And soon there will be everywhere. Status Anonymous meetings in every town, I hope.
You and the hamster in your brain are listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and his weird friends.
You've read books, attended lectures, and you know the Constitution well enough to know it's a well-crafted blueprint to create an ever-increasing federal empire. But there's still one thing missing.
Buttons!
Freedom Fiends now has buttons. You'll get state speech as hate speech, guns and weed, buy sheep for sheep on sheep, and two designs for the Freedom Fiends. Wear them with pride. Use them to start conversations with statists.
It's only $10 for 10 buttons, including shipping.
Go to freedomfiends.com and click on the link at the top that says buttons.
What does freedom mean? Tune in to LRN.FM to find out. LRN.FM is the Liberty Radio Network, a collection of live talk radio and podcasts, all coming from a principled pro-liberty perspective. LRN.FM show hosts aren't left, right, or conspiracy kooks. You can tune in 24/7 to LRN.FM via your phone, computer, satellite, and more. Listen free anytime at LRN.FM. That's LRN.FM.
You know, in the last segment, when I said that people said I looked like Lane Staley and Kurt Cobain back then, I wasn't saying, like, I'm cool, I look like those people. What I was really getting at was, and Kurt Cobain, like, loved my band Bomb. We have that on record from Chris Novoselic in an interview we did with him. But, you know, so it's not like I'm just fantasizing about, like, oh, I had some connection to those people. Like, you know, he actually loved my band, Kurt Cobain did. And so did Chris Novoselic. But what I was getting at was, like, my mother would see them in magazines and like hear about their drug problems. And she kind of didn't know about my drug problems as much because I was on the other side of the country. And she'd be like, I hope you don't end up dead like these people, or like Kurt. You know, Kurt died way before Lane. But so it's kind of weird that, like, my mother saw me in these people and they had very public problems. All right. So, Ben, let's talk about step 10 in Status Anonymous. What do you got?
Yeah, so we're also reading out of the book 12 Steps and 12 Traditions by Bill W. from 1953. And there's a great line that's in the chapter on step 10 in that book. It says, "A continuous look at our assets and liabilities and a real desire to learn and grow by this means are necessities for us." And, you know, I mentioned self-defense before the break, that this is sort of a self-defense thing. We're defending ourselves against our greatest enemy, which is oftentimes ourselves. And an inventory, I used to run different restaurants. I came out of high school, had a very successful crime career that I had to break away from and break away from drugs at the same time. And once I was clear of that, I worked in a chemical factory for about 8 years. And at the end of 8 years, a very small employment base in this chemical company, there was only a couple hundred of us, and the cancer rate was tremendous among employees of this company. So by the 8 years, I was ready to get out of there. I didn't want to expose my family to what bringing home every day in my clothes. I didn't like what I was breathing. I didn't like the atmosphere. So I got it in my mind that I wanted to be a restaurant owner. And so I went through the paths of trying to find out what, you know, how can I break into this industry? And to do so, the quickest, easiest, and cheapest way was to become a manager of a pizza, major chain pizza restaurant. And so I did that, and I got really good at it. I was, you know, not patting myself on the back unnecessarily, but I was one of the top managers in Southern California of that pizza restaurant chain. And I was well recognized as that, and I was rewarded for that and everything. But one of the things that really set me apart from other managers is that I was on top of the inventory. When I went in and took over a store, the first thing I did was I did a complete inventory of everything in the store, not just the food, but every piece of paper, every box, everything. And I looked at all the assets and all the liabilities, and that included every single employee. And I went into it knowing that there was a good chance that I was going to lose most of the employees, because the things that I was bringing in to teach them were going to be completely different than anything they'd ever experienced before. I was taken and put into stores, into pizza restaurants, that were already failing or had already failed or were having serious problems. So I knew going into it that it was time to clean house. And the absolute most necessity in a situation like that is to find out what your liabilities are and what your assets are. And that's your initial inventory when you get there. And that includes all the food and, like I just now said. But then every single day, and almost minute by minute as the day progresses, you have to keep a running inventory in your head of everything that you have, where your employees are, who's available if somebody breaks down or somebody gets sick or whatever, who can you call to bring them in an emergency. You have to constantly be rolling these things through your mind. And at the end of the day, you have to take an inventory every single day. And then periodically, which is at least once a week, you do a big inventory on everything in the store. And then once a month, you do this again. You do a complete and thorough inventory every month. And the only way you can know what's going on in that store is by, or restaurant, is by keeping this ongoing procedure of inventory, of looking at your assets and your liabilities and staying on top of it. And this is exactly the same with recovery of any kind, whether we're talking about, you know, drugs, alcohol, or learning to not be dependent upon government. It takes constantly looking at yourself and looking at your liabilities and looking at your assets and being brutally honest with yourself in doing this and seeing, is there something slipping through the cracks that I'm not noticing? Where's it all going?
Yeah.
And how can I turn it around? Yeah.
We'll be back after this trip to the market with a bunch of stores who probably take inventory. Who probably take inventory regularly if they stay in business.
Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean. This is what radio sounds like now.
This show survives on donations from fiends like you. We put that money back into our show and Liberty Outreach and donate most our ad space to Liberty organizations that make a difference. We're also a teaching hospital, educating the next generation of Liberty talkers on the skills needed to keep the radio flame of truth burning into the future. Put your money where your heart is and make a donation of any amount to the Freedom Fiends. Please go to freedomfiends.com and click on the spinning coin on any post.
Freedom Fiends. Talking about the 10th step of Status Anonymous. Step 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. So basically, this is just doing an 8th and 9th step every day. You know, doing little ones at the end of the day or in your mind as you go along. And you know, that same article from Salon.com that I'm talking about by that guy whose job is debunking AA and proving it doesn't work despite the fact that millions of people have seen it work in their life. One of his criticisms was that taking personal inventory doesn't help alcoholics. Most alcoholics are painfully aware of their misgivings and their misdeeds, and it doesn't help them. Being aware that you're, you know, doing scummy things to people is not the same as really internalizing it to your innermost self. And taking these steps and really, not just real, like every alcoholic, I've been in a bar in my cups, in the depth of my addiction, toasting, literally like holding a glass up and saying, to alcohol, to my alcoholism. That's not really conceding to your innermost self that you're an alcoholic, because to concede to your innermost self that you're an alcoholic is to concede that you will drink until it kills you at an early age in a very sick way.
Yeah. You know, this kind of reminds me, I've known a lot of people in my life that were more than willing to stand and look at you and ask you, you know, what's wrong with me? Tell me, you know, what's wrong? And they'll stand right there and you can say to them, this is what your problem is, and this is what you need to do to overcome that problem. But they don't hear it. I mean, the words go in their ears, and it vibrates things inside their inner ear, and you know, it makes electrons run around inside their brain, but they don't hear a word you say.
Yeah.
They're not open to that criticism. And that's really the difference. Even in dealing with these issues like this, you have to not only be willing to admit it and say, yeah, you know, there's clearly a problem here, but you have to be open to the modifications in your life that, and if you're not willing to really open up to that criticism and respond to it correctly, then it's a lost cause anyway.
Yeah.
It's kind of the same with giving. This is kind of off on a tangent, but it's kind of the same if you've ever known anybody in your life who constantly comes to you for advice, and they actually, you know, really, really want to hear what you have to say, and then they don't take your advice. It's people like that, at some point, you know, you really got to say, look, I'm not going to tell you my opinion. I'm not going to tell you what to do because you're not going to do it anyway.
Yeah.
And you have to, for their own good and for your own good, you have to step away from them.
Worms.
Yeah. That's difficult to do, though, you know, especially when somebody comes to you for advice. It's kind of a human response to want to tell them what's wrong with them.
Knowing what's wrong with them, you know, I'm saying the same thing over and over in different ways, but it's a really important point. You know, like the first step of 12-step programs are admitting you have a problem, and it's like just saying out loud, I'm an alcoholic. Like, isn't really admitting it. You know, it's not really examining it. And you have to really examine it. And you know, that's kind of the reason people say at meetings, you know, I'm Michael and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, Michael. It's doing two things. One is it's doing a first step every time you raise your hand at a meeting and talk. And the other thing is it's kind of saying you can recover. Like when you say, hey, I'm Michael and I'm an alcoholic, you're doing a first step. And when everybody says, hey, Michael, it's kind of saying we do recover, you know, because it's not saying I'm an alcoholic and I'm going to drink till I die. It's saying I'm an alcoholic, and if I drink, I know I'm going to die, but we do recover. Like it's kind of, taking the power out of the doom that, you know, the lie that once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic, or once an addict, always an addict. And, you know, recovering alcoholics do say, you know, they're not cured. Like, they're still alcoholics who don't drink, you know, for the rest of their life. And that's another thing that people who don't like 12 steps have a lot of problems with, because they don't want to admit that they have a problem that is with them forever. And they don't like the disease model of alcoholism. And I think with Status Anonymous too, I think that's worth remembering too, because it's really easy to say like, oh, the government is horrible. Everything's horrible. People, anyone who uses government guns on anybody is horrible. And then like, we've seen time and time again, like name libertarians who like, when the going gets tough, they run to the government, you know, and they issue DMCAs or, you know, they go work at companies that work with intellectual property, or they call the cops on their neighbors for loud music or whatever. So I guess we could say we are statists, you know. I don't know. Do you feel like you're cured of statism forever, Ben? Do you really feel like you are? You might.
It's an ongoing thing. I have to constantly, like we're talking about on this step, I have to constantly take inventory of myself and ask myself, you know, am I following these things? Am I keeping myself free of this? Am I allowing myself to be put in a situation where I'm dependent upon this? Or am I constantly, you know, am I working towards greater freedom and not towards more slavery? You know, there's another thing, too. You kind of mentioned this in the first segment about going to, like, a psychiatrist or any... And we're not against psychiatrists. We're not, you know, we're not besmirching an entire classification of medicine or whatever. But you got to keep in mind that psychiatrists have a very strong history, a track record of working hand in hand with oppressive governments.
And it's gotten worse lately. I mean, and like Obamacare is going to make it worse too, because it actually, Obamacare actually undoes some of the protections of HIPAA, which HIPAA is the thing that says that, you know, it's really hard legally to share someone's secret medical information. And yeah, I'm not against the idea of psychiatry in general, but first of all, psychiatry is basically where, you know, dentistry and surgery was when they were practiced by blacksmiths. It's in its infancy, really. And there's a lot of conflicting ideas in it of what's right. And there's a lot of, conflicting, you know, like medicine is science, and psychiatry is less science, because there's more variables of the human psyche than there are of the human physiology. But even medicine, there are still, it's not science. It's not like Star Trek where they wave. Oh, and I want to say, I'm kind of sad that, Spock died, man. Spock was a cool guy.
Yeah,
I liked him. Leonard Nimoy. Now, Leonard Nimoy was cool too. He was an artist. He was kind of a philosopher. I dug him. I was actually sad when he died. So it's, you know, medicine is not like, Star Trek where they just wave, you know, something, a 1960s iPhone over you and it tells the doctor exactly what's wrong with you. I mean, there are many people who go to doctors and are misdiagnosed or, you know, wrongly diagnosed, or all sorts of things happen. I mean, there are, you know, symptoms overlap so much in so many diseases, and sometimes people have two diseases at once. I mean, there's a whole show based on that, House. It's a doctor who's job is throwing different cures at people until he finds out, you know, the one that's killing them, he stops giving them and gives them the other one until he figures out what the actual thing is. And that's a real thing. That's based on a real type of diagnostic medicine. And again, like, physical medicine is far, and surgery are far more a science than psychiatry. And physical medicine is still not a perfect science, you know, the way that like mathematics or electronics are. You know, there's always the right answer that comes up. And psychiatry also is just so wrapped up in the state. I mean, psychiatry was used by the Soviet Union. Basically, they diagnosed anyone who didn't love, you know, the socialist communist state of the Soviet Union. Anyone who spoke out against it was diagnosed as having psychological, you know, mental illness and was put in a mental institution. And those things like that have happened in America. They're not as common, but they're becoming more common. And the new, you know, big book of crazy that all the psychiatrists use, what's it called? The DSM? The new one basically, you know, it has this designation called ODD, oppositional defiant disorder, which basically if you read the description of it, it basically means you don't like authority. So
yeah,
they have classified not liking authority as a disease. So psychiatry is just really, really wrapped up in the state and getting more so. And that's why you read all these articles by psychiatrists and psychologists saying that AA doesn't work well or doesn't work or has all these problems. They have a financial incentive to do that because, you know, AA costs nothing. You can go to an AA meeting and never spend a dollar. And like, if you don't have money for the books, they'll give you the books. But, you know, I mean, really what it costs is like, I don't know, $20 for the book. And you're supposed to put a dollar or two in the basket to pay for the coffee and the room rental. And, you know, if you have that money, you put it in. So basically, like, it costs $2 a day versus like going into a recovery facility, which costs thousands, can cost thousands of dollars a day, or going to a psychiatrist, which, you know, they cost about $300 a session. And their session is even an hour. It's like 45 or 50 minutes. Because they have to go in the other room and like laugh at your problems with their nurse between sessions. That's what I would think.
Yeah. You know, we also, we're going to talk about the geographic cure. And we have a couple minutes before the next break. We could throw that in. The geographic cure being that somebody is always going to feel like that the problem that they're having is because they're in this location, this city, this town, this state, this country. And, you know, if they could just get over there, if they could just move to that other place, then their alcoholism or whatever, their statism, whatever, all their problems would vanish. All their ghosts would go, then the demons in their mind would all leave them alone if they could just get to this other place. And we wanted to differentiate between the desire to wander, which I think a lot of humans have, just the desire to travel and wander, and the need to move for either political or economic reasons, as opposed to that desire to flee from your ghosts and your demons, thinking you're going to get away from something that lives in your brain.
Yeah, you're not. You're going to show up and, you know, the saying is, you know, I moved to get away from my alcoholism, but it was waiting for me on my doorstep at my new house. And there's no lib pair for getting away from recovery. There's no libertarian paradise. And the same thing with like, you can move places with more freedom. But I kind of tend toward the idea more of like trying to live more free life in your own brain and in your own town and in your own home as much as you can. Yeah, the geographic cure doesn't work. It's a sarcastic thing when people say the geographic cure, like, oh, you're taking the geographic cure, huh? And it doesn't work. Like, you know, you can find drugs and alcohol anywhere. You can find alcohol anywhere on the globe. You can find drugs anywhere. If you're in Europe, just go to the train station. If you're in America or anywhere else, you just go to the methadone clinic and ask someone, or standing in line. Or if they don't have a methadone clinic, you just go to the welfare department and find the most tore up drug addict looking person waiting in line for welfare and ask them. They'll help you out. And I'm not saying do it. I'm just saying, like, you can't get away from it. And you can't, you know, if you think you can go to a town where you don't know any drug dealers, it's not going to work. You'll find them if you want. You got to change your head, man.
You're listening to The Freedom Fiends, an invigorating alternative to those other shows.
Are you tired of your taxes funding endless occupations around the world? Antiwar.com is run by people who understand that wars abroad become wars at home, wars on our freedoms. Antiwar.com is dedicated to bringing you the latest in news, views, interviews, and reviews from the top movers and shakers in the anti-occupation movement. Antiwar.com has it all, from thorough foreign policy analysis to interviews with whistleblowers who used to run the military-industrial complex. Anti-war, pro-free market. That's antiwar.com.
Are you sick of government lackeys who say, you didn't build that? Are you tired of elitists like Barack Obama and Al Gore taking credit for the web while trying to take over the web? Are you disgusted by experts whose concept of the internet is that it's a series of tubes? Take back the free market of computing by encouraging software developers to adopt the BIPCOT NoGov license. The BIPCOT NoGov license allows any use or modification except by governments. Go to BIPCOT.org. That's Bravo, India, Papa, Charlie, Oscar, Tango.org.
Freedom Fiends. Ben Stone, the Bad Quaker, and myself being Michael W. Dean, are talking about the 10th step of Status Anonymous, our 12-step fellowship for getting away from the love of the state And the 10th step is basically taking a daily inventory and admitting your wrongs and correcting them, and, you know, kind of correcting, like, you can't just put a boat with a fixed rudder and a motor and expect it to go to the spot on the other side of the shore. It has to be able to correct for variations that come up, for different wind patterns and storms and water ripples and things. So it's kind of like that. And, you know, governments are really bad at doing any kind of things that would resemble self-improvement or the steps. Occasionally they'll throw some cop under the bus when he murders a bunch of people and there's a big national stink about it. But usually they'll just, cover it up and give him 2 weeks paid vacation and try to hide it.
They'll investigate thoroughly and decide that he followed procedure.
So we're on the radio in Chicago. So in the second hour, we're going to talk extensively about this thing, Holman Square. Is that how you say it? Holman?
I think so.
Holman Square, where it's basically turned out that the police there have a Guantanamo Bay-style black site, a place where people are interrogated and somewhat tortured, perhaps, denied access to attorneys. Held indefinitely in an old Sears building. And if you can't stick around for the second hour, be sure to Google this. Go on YouTube and search a U.S. domestic black site inside one protester's secretive police detention, or Google the disappeared Chicago police detain Americans at abuse-laden black site on Google. So let's go back to the 10th step, because we, unlike governments, try to improve ourselves and live decent lives. Governments seem to live by theft, fraud, aggression, and lies. You know, police are trained to lie to you, but if you lie to them, it's a crime. That's kind of weird.
You know, a lot of people don't realize it, but Martha Stewart, when she went to jail, she did not go to jail for insider trading. That's not what she was convicted
for lying.
Of. She went to jail for lying to a cop.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
They lied to her. They lied to her and baited her into lying. And as soon as she lied, they had her. That's obstruction of justice, and off she goes.
Yep. All right. So 10th step. Let's work on correcting our own problems. Keeping our side of the street scene clean.
We continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. We've kind of been focusing on the inventory, but the wrong promptly admitted it thing is something that is really hard for a lot of people. But we've kind of made almost a part of the show out of going back and saying,
wrong.
I was wrong.
Yeah, that's a segment. Basically, when I say something and find out later I was wrong, I do a segment, a little, not apology, but just correction, saying I was wrong. And that's how I say it. It's good practice too that's a problem I have with a lot of talk show hosts and Liberty Media people, is they very, very rarely, almost approaching never, admit when they were wrong. They just, brush it up or go on, or in some cases, like, edit the media to pretend they never said it. That's not good teaching hospital stuff, man.
No, and it's just the opposite of what we stand for. I mean, we shine the light of truth on everything, including ourselves. And when we're wrong, we want to admit it.
Yeah.
That's part of that personal inventory.
And we're far from perfect. We do a lot of I was wrong. That is far from perfect, but it's better than not doing it by far.
You know, there's a thing in business called Pearson's Law. And it was thrown at me constantly when I worked for a major, I guess I can say General Electric Aircraft Engines, which was a great company to work for, by the way. They were always really good with me. But they always threw Pearson's Law at us constantly. Whatever is measured improves. And I always thought, that's not true. I mean, there are true elements of that. You, in order to improve something, you do, in most cases, need to measure it. But just the measuring alone is not what improves it. You can measure it all day, and if you don't do anything about it, you haven't improved it.
Yeah.
And that's really the key. That's the difference. I think we were talking earlier about the same thing in a different way, that it's not just reflecting on something. It's not just admitting that you have the problem, but it's constantly refining, what it is about you. And constantly not just admitting to it, but constantly seeking a way to change it. That's really where the rubber meets the road on this thing.
Yeah. Yep. And Pearson's Law is about taking inventory in an engineering sense.
We'll be up that guy front. Was a square, dude.
What's that?
That guy was a square, Pearson.
Pearson? Yeah, I'm looking at a picture of him. All right, so we'll be back for hour two of the Freedom Fiends after this trip to the free market.
Words.
For some reason in this country, and in most of the Western world, it's okay to just dodge.
Hey, this is Michael Dean from the Freedom Fiends radio show. Computer programmer Derek Slopey and I have created FiendPhone. I'm using FiendPhone right now to talk with and record one of my co-hosts in real time. Take it, Davi.
Hey, this is Davi Barker, and I'm 1,000 miles away from Michael, but we sound like we're in the same room.
We sure do, Davi. So, Davi, please tell the nice people more about FiendPhone.
FiendPhone is free, no-gov software that opens up a global world of possibilities for collaborative, high-quality, remote voice media production, and I'm digging it.
People can try FiendPhone right now at FiendPhone.com, but we're also raising money to vastly improve FiendPhone and vastly improve independent talk media worldwide.
So go to FiendPhone.com to help out. Who will build the audio roads? We will, with your help.
That's FiendPhone.com, FeendPhone.com, Foxtrot, Echo, Echo, November, Phone.com.
FiendPhone, I never knew remote audio could be this good.
Broadcasting through the Libertarian Reeducation Center's low orbit ion cannon, high atop Financial Beast Plaza on the artificial satellite, LivePair 2017 in the Alpha Centauri region. The Freedom Fiends is covered by a BIPCOT no government license. This allows reuse by anyone except governments. Learn more at BIPCOT.org. That's, Bravo, India, Papa, Charlie, Oscar, Tango.org. I'm Mr. Michael Dean. I'm talking to Ben Stone, Bad Quaker. I got a flu, but you know what? We do radio no matter what, because we care that much. And we don't make very much money at it, almost none, because we do this as a labor of love, and we don't take ads from things that we wouldn't use, and we basically give our ads away to other liberty organizations. So if you want to make a donation, go to freedomfiends.com. And click on the spinning coin on any post. And we do take Bitcoin. We also take PayPal. We also take silver bars and platinum and Swiss bank accounts. No, I'm kidding. All right. So we're talking about the 10th step of Status Anonymous. But we're going to take a little diversion here since we're on the radio in Chicago. Chicago, if you just want to disappear for a week, I've seen a postcard of that. It's got a picture of this place where they're detaining people, and that's your dog. And, you know, Chicago's a great town. I spent a lot of time there. I like it. It's fun. Played there with my band back in the day, played at the Metro, played at Batteries Not Included, hung out with members of the band Big Black, and yeah, it's got a lot of cool stuff that I've always dug. But it's also got a long history of governments that basically act like the mafia or worse. You know, I remember as a kid watching the Democratic Convention in the 60s. What was it, 69, 68, 67? I was a little kid. I don't 68. Remember. 68. Yeah. 68.
Yep.
Where Daley, Mayor Daley, just had people go in and beat up protesters and just be horrible to them and take them off to cages and detain them and deny them the ability to contact a lawyer. I think that's called a Chicago sunroof, isn't that? Where you get detained and you can't contact a lawyer. There should be a name for that, like the Chicago legal treatment or something. And, you know, then Daley's son, they had a dynasty. They had another Daley there who wanted to take away your guns and your rights and act like the mafia. And now it's that guy from Obama. Who's the mayor there now?
Oh, yeah. I can't remember his name.
That's horrible.
I can vision his face.
Is it Rahm Emanuel?
Yeah, that's him. Yeah.
All right, so we're going to play this short thing from the UK Guardian. It's a 3.5-minute piece about what's going on in Chicago. And if you don't know about this, I don't know that everyone in Chicago probably knows about this. It's probably not much on the news. So here we go, man.
This old warehouse on Chicago's west side is not a typical police facility. It's called Homan Square. Lawyers and criminologists describe it as Chicago's equivalent of a CIA black site.
And you go in, nobody knows what happened to you. It's almost like they throw a black bag over your head and make you disappear for a day or two in just their interrogation facilities.
In May 2012, Brian Jacob Church traveled to Chicago to protest the NATO summit. Police arrested him on suspicion of terrorism charges, but no one knew where he was taken.
When they first arrested us, they took us to this building. We were never booked or we were never processed. I was in Holman Square for about 17 hours, you know, handcuffed to a bench before I was actually finally allowed to see an attorney.
The right to remain silent is fundamental in criminal justice. So is access to a lawyer. At Holman Square, Church says you get neither. With his lawyers unable even to find him, no one could enforce his rights.
I had essentially figured, all right, well, they disappeared us, and so we're probably never going to see the light of day again.
Holman Square isn't obviously a police facility, but there are cop vehicles parked outside. Anti-gang, anti-vice, and other special units operate inside, where the public is barred from seeing what goes on.
So essentially, the bench was about this wide, and at the back, it had a bar that came across like this. They wouldn't unhandcuff us to sleep. So when I slept with like my hand cuffed to the bar, and I was kind of slept like this. All of our ankles were handcuffed together as well. I asked them to make a phone call. I asked, you know, to talk to my lawyers. And again, they pointed at the phone number and was like, oh, you're not getting any phone calls from here. And they're like, just tell us what we want to know and you can go home.
Lawyers eventually found Church through a tip-off from Chicago Politicos. After approximately 20 hours inside Holman Square, he was taken to an actual police precinct.
Holman Square's definitely an unusual place. It brings to mind the interrogation facilities that they use in the Middle East. That's essentially what this place, Holman Square, is. It's a domestic black site.
Out says that the Guardian was refused access to Holman Square. Brian Church and his co-defendants were found not guilty of all terrorism-related charges. He's currently on parole after serving. So, okay, here's more.
Oversaw one of the most brutal interrogations on record at Guantanamo Bay. But Zuli tested versions of his interrogation techniques on the Chicago streets he policed.
Wow. What do you think of that, Ben?
Yeah, it's pretty messed up. You know, that kind of stuff has gone on in tyrannical third world countries. We've known about this for a long time. And in the last 10 to 15 years, the U.S. government is starting to do that same kind of stuff with foreigners done in foreign countries. But now we're seeing real evidence that it's happening with police forces here in the United States, with American citizens. It's really, you know, how can you not be shocked by that or angered or have some kind of an emotional feeling about that?
It's bizarre to me when people who consider themselves small government advocates, like a lot of Tea Party people, who, you know, meet someone who's a police officer and say, thank you for your service to the police, because the police are basically the enforcement arm of bad politicians. And
yeah,
I've seen a lot of interviews with police where, you know, they're like, would you enforce any law out there? And a few of them will say no, but those are the ones that are being weeded out and replaced with a lot of the people they're replacing them with are people fresh out of combat in the Middle East, you know, who have looked at everyone as the enemy, have, you know, dealt in situations where there's no constitutional protection of people, where have worked in places where they're basically, you know, will go into anybody's house anytime and search it. You know, and the thing is, if you think, well, those protesters are bad people. It's good that the police rough them up and hide them in this place. First of all, you certainly don't believe in the U.S. Constitution if you believe in that, because the First Amendment guarantees the right to be able to protest. And second of all, that stuff could get switched and used against you. You know, like if you're, you know, if you're a Republican, let's say, and you believe like, oh, well, that kind of stuff should be used against people who do things that Democrats like that I don't like, or vice versa. You know, what if the next president, basically there's a power structure in place that is available to whatever tyrant is filling that seat. And you don't know that the next guy, you know, like let's say you're anti-pornography and you believe there should be a police state to prevent adults from looking at pictures of adults, consenting adults. And you think that should be enforced, which is ridiculous. But if you believe that, like, so, and say you have a religious basis for it, what if the next president has that in place and is really not only pro-porn, but is also like anti-Christian and believes that Christianity is hate speech, as we've seen more and more, like, you know, Christians being forced to, you know, make wedding, like wedding cake makers being forced by law to cater gay weddings, even though they don't want to, when anybody should have a choice of who they do business with, regardless of, anything. And, you know, so if you've got this enforcement in place for things you don't like, what's going to happen when the guy in charge, the next guy who's elected or appointed, believes that things that you do should be illegal, you know, like reading the Bible? It could happen, man. It's you can't back tyranny for your stuff and be a moral person. And you also can't expect it won't be used against you at some point. What do you think, Ben?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. First off, you know, I consider myself a Christian. I'm a Quaker. I'm an ordained minister. I have gone to theology classes. I can put out all of the credentials and everything. But for me to be consistent in my thoughts and to be to embrace the truth and to embrace what Quakers refer to as the light, which is what we feel is Christianity. In order to do that, I cannot then use the power, the aggression of government to force my will upon somebody else. Jesus didn't do that, certainly. And so why would I want to do that? And yet, you know, when we see something like this so often, the people that you know, whether we're talking about what's happening there in Chicago at that one location, or whether we're talking about police brutality, or whether we're talking about kicking in a door because somebody inside that house might be selling some horrible plant product that we're all terrified of or whatever. And we should mention, too, that neither of us are drug users. So it's not like we're just looking for an excuse to be able to smoke our pot or whatever. That's not the case. But when you think that it's good to have police that have the power to kick in a door and violate someone's home with guns drawn just for the purpose of getting a plant, if you think that's good, what are you going to think when those same cops, when the laws change and those exact same cops now are ordered to go in and get guns? When they're told that guns, a specific type, let's say, you know, right now they're playing around with the idea of outlawing a specific type of ammunition. Okay, what about when they come for that? What are you going to do then? Because you've trained them to go after a substance, a thing, rather than a crime. What do you think, Michael?
Just say no. Just say no to tyranny, man. That's what I say.
Yeah.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends. So much truth, it hurts. Skrr, 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 skrr.
Freedom Fiends. Ben Stone, the Bad Quaker, and myself, Michael W. Dean, are just back from a black site at an undisclosed location where we've been interrogated by hamsters. And we're going to talk more about the 10th step of Status Anonymous. Go, Ben, go, Ben, go, Ben, go.
Yeah, so we continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. So I wanted to kind of bring this back to the restaurant analogy. I did work as a restaurant manager with a major chain of restaurants for a while, and I kind of set up a pattern because I was used as a to go from one store to the other to fix the problems that were in there. I would go in, I'd spend anywhere from 3 to 6 months turning a store around, and you're then like, I'd go on to the next one.
You're like the pizza Marines.
Yeah, hit the beaches, bodies flying everywhere.
Thank you for your food service.
But I was thinking about the four types of inventories and the processes that I went through when I took over a restaurant like that. And I kind of tried to put them into these steps that we're talking about with Status Anonymous. So I'll read this, the four types of inventory. Number one, the start of responsibility, you do this with your sponsor or advisor. And this is a complete, thorough inventory of everything. This is a going through, and we've talked about this in the other steps. You go through, you make your lists, you really look at things, but it's thorough. And it's with your sponsor or advisor present. So you're kind of kicking them off of each other. Then number two, there's the running moment-by-moment inventory. This is a self-analysis that you kind of have to keep rolling in your head all the time. Am I living the steps? Am I living my life the way I want to be living my life? Or am I slipping back? When sometimes, you know, your mouth opens and you start to talk before your brain engages, catch yourself doing that and watch. Are you living moment by moment right now in these steps? And are you consistently following through? And then their third type of inventory was end-of-the-day summary. So in a restaurant, at the end of the day inventory, you don't inventory everything. You inventory the main stuff that you sell, and that gives you a quick financial capability of seeing whether or not you made money or not today. You can kind of get an idea of if you're getting low on anything, if you need to get it ordered for the next day or that kind of thing. So you've got that moment by moment running inventory, but then at the end of the day, you know, when you sit down and you're relaxing, and rather than just staring blankly at a TV or whatever, you kind of run through the course of the day. And I think originally I suspect that an evening prayer kind of was used like this, a moment of meditation at the end of the day. Not only does it calm your brain and prepare you for sleep, but it also a little reflection on how the day went, and a little honesty with yourself about the events of the day, I think is a really good thing to do every single
day. Well, step 11, actually.
And then the fourth type of inventory is a comprehensive review, again, with your sponsor or advisor, with whoever that person is that's trusted that you can work with. And the purpose in this is to compare your current situation with the way it was when you started. What progress have I made? What have I been able to conquer? And what have I not been able to deal with? And I need to stop putting it off and deal with that. And one of those occasionally is really important to have. So those are my four types of inventories.
Yeah.
The other thing that I wanted to touch on is, well, let me back up just slightly again and just reread. I'm not sure if we read the step in this segment or not. We continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. And so that's dealing with the inventory half. And as we've been talking about, the promptly admitting it, whether we've wronged somebody else or whether we're wronging ourselves or whether we're deceiving ourselves, the quicker we can deal with it, you know, it's kind of like getting a splinter. You know, if you've ever gotten a splinter and if you don't get it out immediately, it will start to get worse. It'll start to fester. It'll get infected, it's according to what kind of a splinter it is. If some types of wood carry tannins that are slightly mildly poisonous. And so you'll start to get irritation there. The longer you put off dealing with the splinter, the worse it's going to hurt when you have to dig it out. And if it's something like a piece of metal or glass, the longer you put off dealing with it, the deeper it can dig. And that means you've got to get in there and dig it out. And it's going to hurt that much more to try to get it out of there. So we're going to come back in the next half an hour
Worms.
More on this topic.
Morons. Morons. Morons on this topic.
You're listening to the Freedom Fiends, and I'm beaming these words into your cerebellum.
Bad sign, I lost track of time there.
Yeah.
Freedom Fiends. This is Michael Dean talking to Ben Stone, Bad Quaker. Take it, Ben.
So I was talking about inventories and talking about my restaurant experiences and so forth. And when I would go in and having to deal with a staff that had never heard of this stuff before and never had to, you know, face the kind of discipline that I was bringing on, I would always get excuses from the assistant managers and so forth. They'd say, you know, I don't have time to just keep a continuous inventory going. I don't have time to keep track of this stuff. I've got work to do. I just can't, you know, I can't be burdened with another thing. And they would always have these excuses. And the thing you have to realize when, as far as Status Anonymous goes, and this would probably apply to Alcoholics Anonymous as well, but the thing that you need to realize is when you start making those excuses like that, again, you're being your worst enemy, and you need to practice self-defense on that enemy. You need to face those excuses, face the shortcuts, and realize that you're only ripping yourself off. You're only lying to yourself.
The shortcuts or the shortcomings, or both, actually.
Yeah, both, actually. So, you know, when you say, well, I don't have time to do that, or, you know, that's a lot of work, I don't need that extra burden, you're actually putting more on yourself than if you just stop and deal with it. Now, putting this in a frame of thinking about statism, if you think about it, war is the inevitable result of faith in the state. War always results from faith in the state. The war is the most dangerous aspect of faith in the state. And if you think about it, how do these people in government, how do these government actors, how do they convince people to send their children and their loved ones, their spouses, to be maimed and twisted and killed by war? How is it? What magic is there that causes a person to shove their son out the door in a uniform and say, go to the other side of the world and kill people that we would have no association with under any other circumstances? You'll never meet them. You'll never know them. They're not a direct threat to you. Go to the other side of the globe and kill them. How would you motivate somebody to do this? And how do government actors convince people to slaughter people when those people are not a direct threat to us, to Americans or to individuals or even to the person who's being sent out the door?
Patriotism and nationalism.
It is. It's based on lies, on fear and anger and hate and jealousy and envy and pride. And none of those things, all of those are out of balance aspects of the human experience. And that's what the government relies on, this twisted sense of pride in the accomplishments of other people. That's what nationalism is.
And you're not just talking about the United States federal government. We're talking about every government worldwide throughout history. This is the nature of government.
These are the tricks they always use throughout history. Thousands of years they've been pulling this same con, and very few people are catching on to it.
And wars abroad in any country, of any country, become wars at home. You know, if you love your gun rights and you love your right to worship as you please and do business with who you please and not have to make cakes for people you don't want to make cakes for, and you blindly support the military intervention overseas, you are contradictory, because those people are the same people that are going to come home with the training and the arming and the armaments to walk around your town and enforce those laws, to have the war on drugs, the war on guns, the war on religion, the war on free speech, the war on picking your own doctor, all of that, man. You can't be consistent and yell for government in one place and then not want it in another place, because it's one giant beast. And increasing one side of it always increases another side of it.
You know, it's really amazing, too. We've had this so-called two-party system in America, and it's really amazing how many people are fooled by that. They take on a team mentality, and they think, well, my side's good, it's the other side that's bad. And the reality is, there's almost no difference between the two. You know, back in the 60s, a real common phrase was, there's not a dime's worth of difference between them, in reference to the Democrats and the Republicans. The Democrats pretend to be the party of peace until they get into power. The Republicans pretend to be the party of fiscal conservatism until they get into power.
And freedom and constitutional freedoms. Or, you know, they say they love the Bill of Rights. They say they love the Constitution, which really they're saying they love the Bill of Rights. Because if you read it, the Constitution really, all of it except the Bill of Rights sets up the federal blob that we have now that is all-consuming. It basically says they can lay and collect taxes and do whatever they want, and there's no checks and balances really other than other people that are supposed to check and balance them in the government. But those other people, you know, it's been said that every election is just two millionaires arguing over who loves the common man the most, or every election is a popularity contest for sociopaths. And that's really true. I mean, the people who want to become politicians are the people who are, you know, least capable of being just, I would say.
I should say, we haven't said it during this today's show, so I want to say it now, that we believe Obama is a socialist, a liar, and his feet stink.
Absolutely.
And that comes from Michael's father.
Yeah, my 93-year-old dad said that when we had him on the show one time, and I said, what do you think of Obama? And I agree with that. But unlike other talk radio shows, we don't think the answer is Jeb Bush or Mitt Romney or George Bush. We think those guys are also liars, socialists, and their feet stink. Talk about why every politician is a socialist. And it's really funny when one politician calls another politician a socialist or even a statist. I mean, I've heard, I don't know about politics. Yeah, I've heard Sarah Palin called Obama a statist, and I've heard Rush Limbaugh call Obama a statist. That is hilarious. That is the pot calling the kettle black. Right there.
Isn't that amazing? Not long ago, they had the big CPAC thing, the convention.
I was invited to that. Convention. I was invited to go to Radio Row, which is where all the radio hosts line up. I don't know how I got invited. They don't invite everybody. I got an invitation to that, and I wrote the lady back and said, you know, basically, no, they're all socialist liars and their feet stink, and I don't want anything to do with it. I was polite, but I was very firm and I also found the best way ever to get taken off a mailing list. I basically said, no, I don't want to go glorify and interview people who love to use force to, you know, enforce their will on others, which is basically all politicians, regardless of party. And then I said, but feel free to keep me on your mailing list because I love to read these out loud and comment on them on the air. And I've not gotten another email. I'll bet that worked better than if I said, please take me off your mailing list. Like basically I'm going to read this. I read it out loud and read the lady's name who sent it to me. So, we have not gotten another email from her.
at that convention, the politician, Scott Walker, I believe he's a governor from one of those states. But anyway, I you know, there's things like
he's
that.
He's a Massachusetts Republican, which is basically like a California liberal, I think.
Yeah. He made the statement at CPAC. He said, in America, we celebrate our independence from the government, not our dependence on it. And when I heard that, somebody sent it to me in an email, and then I went over and listened to it on YouTube, and I thought, the audacity of these people to just take words and twist them and lie is amazing. I'll say it right out. Scott Walker, I think, is a socialist, a liar, and his feet stink. And when you hear him say something like that, we celebrate our independence from government, not our dependence on it. And then he turns around and uses the government to try to force people to be more dependent on it. It's just amazing. But you ask about why we say that they're socialists. And I think that's really important. A lot of people, especially those that call themselves Republicans, they think they're anti-socialist, and yet they, whether they realize it or not, they're electing socialists. That's what these people are. Socialism is the idea, especially once it's applied to government. And there are theoretical ways to have it in an anarchical way and so forth. But that's not what we see in government. What we see in government is the government form of socialism, which means that they always have used aggression, used soldiers, used police. Police are just domestic soldiers. That's all they are. And they use them to enforce the will of a very small group of people, an elite, and those people make up the laws, and the police then enforce those laws upon everybody else. And they rob from the large quantity of people that are out there actually working real productive jobs, and they take that money, and then they divide it up the way they feel it should be divided up, and they meter some back out, just like in Rome when they gave free bread away to keep the masses from rioting.
And, you know, really,
that's what they do.
The Republicans love to say that the Democrats redistribute wealth, and they do. But so do the Republicans, and every politician ever, probably with the exception of Ron Paul, who was probably the only good politician ever in America who actually obeyed the Constitution, if that's what you're supposed to do, if you believe in government like that. You know, and I say Ron Paul is my favorite government thug, but every politician redistributes wealth mostly to himself and his friends.
Yeah.
You know, the amount that they're stealing away from honest people and from the free market and siphoning to their friends and the people that, you know, get them elected and the lobbyists and the people that pay for their political PACs and things, that so far outweighs whatever the welfare checks add up to. You know, I'm not saying welfare checks are a good thing. They're not. It should all be eliminated. But, you know, the amount of kickbacks to big oil, big pharma, big military contractors, all of those people who basically own politicians, those are the people that get them elected and can tell them what to do. You know, those are the bosses. The amount of money that's siphoned away from you, from us, from everybody is so far, welfare checks are just a drop in the bucket to that, man.
You know, and government costs in another way too. I read recently a very prominent libertarian person writing about the net neutrality, and he's basically, his point of his story was, don't worry about it. The hackers will fix it. You know, we'll work around it. And I realize that. That's probably, there's a lot of truth in that. But here's the thing of it. All efforts made to work around government laws, all of that swallows up effort that could be productive in some other way.
Yeah. I mean, it's basically the equivalent would be, you know, the geniuses, the people that hack away at stuff, the programmers that want freedom. They could be building the flying car, but they're having to spend their time trying to make the existing car work on the crippled railways, the crippled highways that the government keep crippling.
Yeah.
Yeah. All governments steal everything from everyone.
Listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and some of his weird friends. And yes, we're broadcasting this into space.
Hey, this is Nathan Explosion from Death Clock, and you're listening to Freedom Fiends on the radio worms.
Hey, this is Squiskar Squiggles from Death Clocks, and you're listening to the Freedom Fiends on the, you know, the radios. And I guess it says worms now. So there you go.
Freedom Fiends. You know, they say in NA meetings, some of us are sicker than others. I'm sick today, but not that way. I have a flu. So I'm going to let Ben Stone, the Bad Quaker, do the most of the redemption in the third act here, the final segment. Go, Ben. Go, Ben. Go, Ben. Go.
There's a little section in the final part of the chapter from the 12 Steps and 12 Traditions that we were talking about earlier. And I wanted to read this little part here. It says, finally, we began to see that all people, including ourselves, are to some extent emotionally ill as well as frequently wrong. And then we approach true tolerance.
Some are sicker than others.
Some are sicker than others. That's what reminded me of that. And then we approach true tolerance and see what real love for our fellows actually means. So it's kind of like coming to a place where we understand, yeah, there are a lot of sick puppies out there, and we are among them. You know, we're not always right. I'm not always right. And I can't hold everybody I face. I can't hold them to a level to demand that they always be, you know, perfectly mentally on target and always correct. I don't have the capability of doing that.
We tried. We had like months where all we did was took other people's inventory and didn't change those people or any of their followers. So we're done.
And really, it's just a burden on your own mind, trying to be frustrated with other people like that. It's easier to sort of mind your own tiller, so to speak. Here's another part. Such a radical change in our outlook will take time, maybe a lot of time. Most of us have to admit that we have loved but a few, that we have been quite indifferent to the many so long as none of them gave us trouble. And as for the remainder, well, we really have disliked or hated them. And that's kind of a harsh thing to say, you know, but if you take an inventory of all the people that you know and you've encountered and so forth, it's really, if you're true about it, very few of them you really love. You're indifferent about them. And some you really don't like and some you hate. And that's a burden. You know, it's really hard. An old saying is you have to forgive to be forgiven. And that's kind of part of this process. You kind of have to get that. We don't have the luxury of walking around in hate all the time. Now, I want to take that to a status point of view, too. You know, tribal hate is a thing that humans have almost perfected over the eons of time that we've been doing this. But tribal hate, once mankind gets to the population levels that we're at, and once technology gets to the levels that it's at, we no longer can afford the luxury of tribal hate. When you realize, you know, you think about the United States and you think about the United States government and you think about its nuclear arsenal and you think about a country like China and you think about a country like India and Pakistan and Russia and, you know, France, England, all of these countries, Israel, they all have, North Korea, they all have nuclear capability. They can all make stuff blow up in a horrific way. And the United States has a track record of actually using that stuff. Now, for the first time in history, humanity has the capability to extinguish humanity, and maybe not only humanity, maybe all life on the planet. We no longer have the luxury of having tribal hate, of hating somebody on the other side of an imaginary line drawn on a map by some politician. I'm not saying, you know, there's a thing that happens. Bastiat back in the 1800s wrote about this. He says he was kind of the same type of a person of thinking like we are. And he said that our critics, when they hear us saying these things, like if we say the government should not pay for education, then immediately they jump to the conclusion that we're against education. Or if we say the government should not, you know, pick a winner when it comes to religion, so the government should not fund a specific religious group, then they want to accuse us of being anti-religion. Well, this is kind of the same thing there. I'm not saying anything against America. I'm saying that we're all people, all of us. And just because there's a line on a map doesn't make any kind of a magic capability of that line. The people on the other side of that line are just like the people on this side of that line.
Everybody around the world wants the same thing, pretty much, universally. Yeah. I've traveled a lot. They all want to raise their families and have their kids have a better life than they had, and be left alone and have things be the same from day to day in a way that it's not going to destroy the business and the life they build. And I don't mean like sticking to old ways. I mean like that all of a sudden running your own business won't be illegal or close to it the next day. That's the kind of constancy people need to thrive, and that's what they want. Worms.
Worms.